Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Christian. I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program, Advances in the Treatment of Cervical Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Share Cancer Support and Cancer Care. And you'll be hearing more about that partnership and about Share later on in the program as well. Today's program is made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this very important program. It's a program that we actually don't have the opportunity to do that often throughout the year, so we're very happy to be able to give you all the updates now in this program. Before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to let you know how many people are on the call and where you're from. So we have over 200 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Lebanon, Nepal, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call as well. And we're delighted that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. And Dr. Runowitz will be addressing an overview of cervical cancer, including diagnosis and staging. She'll also be addressing combination treatments, the role of the pathologist, and key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you for including me in this teleconference. I'm honored to share this time with my esteemed colleagues. Cancer of the uterine cervix is the third most common gynecologic cancer in the United States. The global incidence varies based on the presence of screening and HPV vaccination. Human papillomavirus, or HPV, is central to the development of cervical cancer and precancer, and can be detected in almost 100% of cervical cancers. The diagnosis of cervical cancer is made by histologic evaluation of a cervical biopsy. And so that means that the woman goes to usually the gynecologist, and the gynecologist will put a speculum in, and the cervix will have a tumor, cancer on it, which the gynecologist will biopsy. The pathologist is essential in this evaluation and determining the type of cervical cancer. The most common histologic types of cancer, and that is after it's examined under a microscope, are squamous cell cancers, which account for about 70% of cervical cancers, and adenocarcinomas, which account for about 25%. The incidence of invasive cervical adenocarcinoma and its variants has increased dramatically over the past few decades, particularly in younger patients. Once a diagnosis is made, the patient undergoes staging. Prior to 2018, this was a clinical stage. However, in 2018, the staging organization called FIGO updated the staging for cervical cancer, which included three size ranges for criteria for stage 1B. So 1B was now divided into three based on the size of the tumor, and a new stage 3C. Based on 2018 staging may include imaging studies such as CT scans, magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs, and PET scan or positron emission tomography and pathologic findings. Since treatments vary from simple to radical surgery with or without chemotherapy, it's very important that the patient seek an opinion from a gynecologic oncologist, radiation oncologist, and have input ideally from a tumor board, which includes a pathologist, medical oncologist, and others to determine the best course of treatment. How does a patient find out if their case was presented to a tumor board? It is very important to have this discussion with your doctor. If it's a gynecologic oncologist, it's most likely going to be presented at a tumor board. But that's a good question to ask your treating physician. And the treatments are broken up into low risk, intermediate risk, high risk. So the treatment for low risk is surgery for stages 1B and 1B2. That is where the tumor is less than 4 centimeters. A radical hysterectomy with lymph nodes by a gynecologic oncologist, and a gynecologic oncologist is a physician who is specifically trained to do these surgical procedures. A less radical procedure in stage 1A2 and selected 1B1s may be performed. Again, it's very important to seek the opinion of a gynecologic oncologist who can give you these options. Radiation therapy is also an alternative option, depending on the medical condition of the patient, the stage, and the histopathology. So, for example, if a patient is quite ill, a radiation treatment might be preferred over exposing an ill patient to surgery. For intermediate risk, it's a combination of chemotherapy and radiation, usually with a platinum-based regimen. Either platinum alone or in combination is the usual recommendation. However, recent data suggests that induction chemotherapy, and that is chemotherapy given before, usually with a platinum-based therapy, may be considered. And again, this would be something that a tumor board, gynecologic oncologist, and a radiation oncologist would discuss. For high-risk patients, a combination of chemoradiation, but not continued after the treatment, and that would be continued as adjuvant. Adjuvant therapy has not been shown to improve overall survival. So it's just the treatments are given, the chemotherapy, just during the radiation. After you finish, it's very important that you continue to follow with your gynecologic oncologist, who will do physical exams, including pelvic examinations, imaging such as CAT scans or PET scans as indicated, and a biopsy if there's something abnormal or if the patient, for example, is bleeding, there may be something that can be biopsied. In recurrent disease, either the disease is just local in the pelvis, or it can be outside of the pelvis, for example, in the chest. So with locally recurrent disease, it usually presents with symptoms of bleeding or abnormal discharge. Treatment may involve radiation therapy or surgery. And again, consultation with a gynecologic oncologist and radiation oncologist is important to develop the best plan of treatment. Getting a second opinion is always an option. Some patients are hesitant that a second opinion will insult their treating physicians, and that's very far from the truth. The metastatic, that is disease that's outside of the pelvis, can be asymptomatic or can have symptoms depending on the site of metastases. Dr. Einstein will discuss the role of bevacizumab, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and other new and novel therapies. It's an exciting time in chemotherapy and immunotherapy and novel therapies in GYN oncology, including cervical cancers. Enrolling in a clinical trial is important. Some patients view this as it being going into some experiment. In fact, it's not. Clinical trials are very well controlled, and they have improved the outcome for our patients, especially over the period that I have been practicing as a GYN oncologist. So I cannot overemphasize the importance of clinical trials. These trials are research studies that involve patients with a certain disease and a certain stage of disease. The clinical trials is at cancer.gov, and it can be confusing, and organizations such as Cancer Care can provide assistance in helping you search for clinical trials. It's very important that you also discuss your quality of life. With surgical removal of the ovaries or with pelvic radiation, the patients may experience premature menopause, sexual dysfunction such as painful intercourse, and urinary symptoms. It is important to bring these issues to the healthcare provider to discuss treatment with systemic or local therapy. If a woman has gone into menopause from the treatment, the woman may experience hot flashes. And there are hormonal and non-hormonal therapies. And there's been significant development in this. There's a new drug, which is a non-hormone, which acts on the brain and is very effective and improves quality of life by reducing the hot flashes. So I think that has covered the assignment that I was given by Dr. Messner, and I will turn the conference call back to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was an outstanding presentation, stellar, and actually you set the tone for today's program. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks for really highlighting such an important introduction to this program today. And our next speaker is Dr. Mark Einstein, and Dr. Einstein is professor and chair, Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology and Reproductive Health, associate dean, clinical research, Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School, associate director, New Jersey Alliance for Clinical and Translational Science, Rutgers Biomedical and Health Sciences. And Dr. Einstein will be addressing new and emerging treatment approaches, how precision medicine and testing inform your treatment decisions, updates on clinical trials, and how research increases your treatment options. It is now my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Einstein.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, for inviting me to this very important program, and thank you to the Cancer Care Network and for SHARE for the sponsorship of this program. And thank you all for joining us today because, let's face it, you are all going to be ambassadors for sharing this information with your friends, with your loved ones, with your colleagues, and getting the word out about the importance, first of all, of knowing what is out there for cervical cancer, that of what we can do to help individuals suffering with this disease and what we can do even to potentially prevent this disease, which in a large part for many people it is preventable. I was asked to talk about some new and emerging treatment approaches, and if you asked me to talk about this, 10 years ago, I would have been giving the same talk for a few years in a row, and I'm really, really happy to say that over the last few years, due to, as Dr. Ronowitz had said, the importance of clinical trials that has gotten out to the communities, but due to the important clinical trials that have happened, we have made quite a few advances in the last few years to greatly improve survival, improve cure for cervical cancer. And as somebody who oversees a number of clinical trials, whenever I have someone that's on a clinical trial, and, we see dramatic responses, all of us are just, smiles. It makes my day, it makes my week, it makes the patient just feel wonderful. And I'm lucky to say that as a provider of care, almost everything that we do in our world today was different than it was 5 years ago, and that is a result of clinical trials. And so I am going to be giving an update of clinical trials, and hopefully it'll help you all to be ambassadors of, you know, not fearing it, because, I mean, everything that you take today, everything, whether it's over the counter or intravenous, had to go through these types of trials to bring it to, shall we say, the marketplace, so that it could come to you. And why is that? Well, we have to show that it actually works for you. I'm going to start actually with just talking about some really innovative stuff that has happened from a surgical standpoint. As GYN oncologists, we not only perform the radical surgeries to help individuals suffering with pelvic tumors, but we also, many of us, oversee the chemotherapy. So the good thing is we know the limitations of both. So just because we have a hammer doesn't mean everything is a nail. We know what works, and just because we can't operate on someone doesn't mean we do. We work very closely also with our medical oncology colleagues. We work closely with our radiation oncology colleagues, so we could really give and administer the best multimodal care for all of these cancers. Something that came out very recently, fresh off the presses in New England Journal of Medicine, which is really one of the premier journals in medicine, was something called the SHAPE trial, where for very early cervical cancer, and this is cervical cancer is something that oftentimes can be even be picked up just from screening, from somebody has a Pap test or an HPV test, and then they get a colposcopy or they get a minimally invasive surgery, and next thing you know, they find out they have like a microinvasive tumor. And what we've learned is that we don't have to do these big radical surgeries. And the SHAPE trial basically took individuals and randomized individuals to the traditional radical surgeries that we did to a more minimally invasive approach, some of them even fertility-sparing approaches, because unfortunately this is a cancer that affects women in the prime of their reproductive lives. So, what was found was that there's very high survivorship in both groups, and just as high of survivorship if we do it either way. And so it gives us good options for our patients, and we can have this really quality shared decision-making with our patients, especially those that might desire to maintain their fertility, and we could actually discuss, you know, with some really good prospective evidence that we really can achieve good survivability and maintain fertility. Another big thing that has recently come out is, as I discussed, we have to use different types of treatments, and Dr. Runowitz talked about the different types of treatments that we use for cervical cancer. Radiation treatment, in fact, even the field of radiation oncology has gotten its start from the treatment of cervical cancer because it works so well. I mean, radiation treatment essentially melts these tumors away. Now the radiation has come such a long way. We use, you know, really fancy targeted therapies and computer-aided treatment planning to really go after, in a very targeted way, the tumor and then sparing the normal tissue around the tumor. But what we've learned is that if we add chemotherapy before we give radiation for patients that are suffering with bulky cervical cancer, what we call locally advanced cervical cancer, we could actually improve survival dramatically. And this was actually presented at the big European conference in this past fall that actually showed that if we actually start with maybe shrinking those tumors, shrinking potentially the local regional lymph nodes of those tumors, and then going at what is remaining with radiation therapy, we could actually really dramatically improve the survival in individuals suffering with bulky tumors. And this can, you know, potentially be a big deal in even low and middle income countries that unfortunately suffer with a lot of cervical cancer, and where there potentially even are long waiting times. During those waiting times, patients could actually get chemotherapy during that time, and the tumors can actually be shrunk while they're waiting for their radiation treatment. In addition to this, there has been a lot of advances with precision medicine in the testing to inform our treatment decisions. So there's been an explosion of molecular and tumor genetic testing that informs our treatment decisions. Right now, it is almost essentially routine for us to remove, when we remove tumors, not just cervix cancer, but almost all tumors, that we send it for tumor testing. And that tumor testing really helps us to inform the targeted therapies that we could use. One of those targets that we're looking at right now is something called PD-1, and PD-1 is really the target that opens up the door for us to use what we call immune checkpoint inhibitors. Immune checkpoint inhibitors are the belle of the ball of not just cervical cancer, but almost all tumors. Okay, you've heard of things like pembrolizumab and many other checkpoint inhibitors where by essentially allowing our immune systems to go after the tumors themselves, we could actually dramatically improve responses of other types of chemotherapies that we use, of other types of other agents that we could combine with an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And for cervix cancer, combining the checkpoint inhibitor with traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy and combining it with something that Dr. Ronowitz had mentioned before, something called bevacizumab, which actually goes after the vascular endothelial growth factors, or VEGF, we give those four treatments in the recurrent setting, and we can actually dramatically improve survival in individuals suffering with recurrent cervical cancer. But now, what we've learned, and something that was actually presented this past weekend in our most recent Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting, and that there's data to support that we could actually use pembrolizumab right up front, okay, right when a patient presents with a locally advanced cervix cancer, that we should not only give them radiation with a little touch of chemotherapy, but we should also be using an immune checkpoint inhibitor in those individuals that actually were using a precision medicine technique, like identifying PD-1, to inform that treatment decision and actually give them pembrolizumab right up front during radiation and following radiation as well. And that extends survival. It decreases the chance that they have recurrence and overall increases the chance of cure, which is really what we're all trying to strive for. In addition to this, I mean, let's face it, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as Ben Franklin had said. And in the prevention data setting, there's a lot more data to support the use of what we call HPV genotyping to determine the risk of precancer and the need for active surveillance. And this sort of feeds into some more clinical trials that we're doing in terms of precision medicine and how it's informing our treatment decisions. But it's not just informing it in the treatment setting, it's informing it in the prevention setting in the cervical cancer world. So there's commercial tests that also there's now new commercial tests that could actually have extended genotyping. So not only is it actually letting us know the potentially worst types of what's happening now, but also telling us like the types that are intermediate types. And all cervical cancers at some point in time start with an HPV infection. So one's knowledge of an HPV infection will actually help to inform how we go about the next steps, if we have to actually do some sort of diagnostic testing. But most importantly, it actually tells us which patients we don't actually have to do anything now to. Okay, it has a wonderful negative predictive value in a screening sort of technology, and the data is very robust, even better than a Pap test ever has. All right, so. And this has actually fed into what is going to be a very large clinical trial that's going to be coming out that is going to lead to what we call self-sampling. So instead of going to the provider for a Pap and an HPV and co-testing like what we've been doing now for decades, we could potentially do this at home with self-sampling. This has already started happening in Scandinavia. This is already happening in the Netherlands. This is already starting to happen in the U.K., in the United States, self-sampling has not been FDA approved, and the goal of what is going to be a National Cancer Institute-sponsored initiative is to overcome the barrier of a lack of an FDA approval for self-sampling. And it's really to increase some of the screening access in order to reduce cervical cancer incidence. And this is going to be a broad study across the United States, going after individuals that might be at risk based on either social determinants of health or access issues that might be at risk for actually developing cervical cancer. This is not going to replace provider-obtained cervical cancer screening, but this might help potentially overcome some of the barriers to screening that we have. This might overcome helping individuals that might not be able to have access. This might be able to overcome, as Carolyn Meisner had said at the beginning of the call, for people that might be in very rural areas that might not be able to get to the provider so easy. I know there's a lot of rural individuals that are on this call today. How nice would it be if you could actually do your screening at home, okay? And you could send it in, and only if it's positive you have to actually go in and see a provider, okay? So, this is a big initiative that is really going to change some of how we do things. And so, once again, I've presented some innovations both on a surgical side, on a treatment side, and, you know, certainly there's a couple of new drugs that have been presented, including something called TIVTEK, T-I-V-T-E-K, tisotumab vedotin, T-I-S-O-T-U-M-A-B-V-E-D-O-T-I-N for the prompter. This is an antibody that binds to a tissue factor. This was also presented at our big Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting that actually, again, this is what clinical trials do. It gives us new drugs that actually help and are active against, for patients suffering with recurrent cervical cancer. And this drug showed that we could actually drastically improve survival with just the use of just this drug alone. Okay, and this data was a big heavy hitting trial that was presented at our big meeting this past weekend. So fresh off the presses, and more to come with something like these types of drugs. But clinical trials really opened up the doors to this, and something that now we can deliver to our patients tomorrow, based on these new innovations. And until we cure this cancer, we need to continue to do these clinical trials so we could strive to improve the outcomes and potentially continue to strive to improve our ability to prevent these cancers as well, so that, you know, I look forward to the day that I don't ever have to see another woman suffering from these cancers again. Thank you very much. I look forward to the questions from the audience.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Einstein. That was really a superb presentation. So much wonderful information for our participants, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so I just want to thank you so much, and very comprehensive, stellar presentation. And our next speaker will be Ayesha McClellan, and Ms. McClellan is with Cervical Cancer Program Coordinator, Share Cancer Support. And she is actually partnering with us on today's program. Share Cancer Support is a partner with us on today's program. And she will be discussing Share's free programs and services, and we'll be discussing their national helpline and website. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Ayesha McClellan.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ayesha McClellan, and I am a metastatic cervical cancer survivor turned patient advocate. I lead the cervical cancer program at Share Cancer Support. Share is a national nonprofit that supports, educates, and empowers anyone who's been diagnosed with breast or gynecologic cancers. We also provide outreach to the general public about signs and symptoms. We have expert-led educational programs and peer-led support groups. We have a national breast, ovarian, uterine, cervical, and metastatic breast cancer helpline. My cervical cancer program also has a text line. There's also Health Unlock communities for breast, ovarian, uterine, and breast cancer. We provide educational tools, clinical trial assistance, outreach to medically underserved communities, and we just launched survivor patient education. All of our programs are in Spanish and Chinese. And that's about it.
Well, what a wonderful resource this is for our participants. And I have to say, I want to thank Ms. McClellan for doing such a superb job in presenting all the services that they offer. And I have to just let you know that after today's program, you'll all be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation, and in that evaluation, there will be a all the phone numbers and websites and things that were mentioned during the program you'll be getting, and then some as well. The evaluation is an evaluation of the program, but it also will include a lot of resources for you as well. So thank you, Ms. McClellan, and we look forward to any questions that may come your way during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she'll be discussing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential, not only to your tolerance to treatment, but also to provide you the energy to do the things that you enjoy and contributing to your quality of life. Now, during your treatment, your diet might be modified. A lot of this just depends on your journey through your treatment. Each person is unique, and each person has unique side effects and experiences. And so although we can turn to friends and family for support and help along our way, please communicate with your healthcare team as things arise. We want to help you as quickly as possible. And so letting us know when you notice a change in your tolerance to diet, if you have any new side effects come up, please reach out to your healthcare team. Some potential side effects that you might experience include things like a poor appetite, nausea, vomiting, maybe a sore mouth or throat, diarrhea, fatigue. During your course of treatment, your nutrition needs can change. Just I said a minute ago, it's all based on your tolerance to treatment. And so each person's unique, so just letting us know as these things happen, we'll be able to support you as quickly as possible. Now, if you know your healthcare team, that really helps you know how to reach out to who you need to. And a dietitian is part of the healthcare team amongst many other members of the team. But the dietitian can help with modifying your diet, giving you information on your nutrition goals, fluid goals, and just answer general questions. A lot of times people just read things on the internet and have questions, should I be doing this and should I be taking that? So a dietitian is a great resource to utilize to answer some of those questions and concerns. Now, I always bring this up. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. I notice a lot of times patients will come in whenever they're starting treatment and they want to turn over a whole brand new leaf, and that's fantastic. But there are times during your treatment when you need to kind of not make so many changes necessarily, especially if you're going through radiation therapy, for example. We like to kind of keep your weight within a pretty tight window of when you were first simulated during your radiation therapy. And then after your treatment's done, then other goals can start to kind of surface and we can work on those. But when you lose weight during your cancer treatment, oftentimes it happens very quickly and it doesn't come off the way we always think it's going to. We lose more muscle and protein stores, which we actually need. Our muscle and our protein are very important to us because it gives us endurance and helps us do the things that we like to do. As we lose muscle, we can actually increase fatigue and not have the energy to do the things that we enjoy. Now, there are medications to help with side effects. So again, please talk with your healthcare team as things arise. If you're confused about how to take your medication or you have medication and it's not working, talk with your healthcare team. Maybe you're not taking it exactly like it could be most effective. Maintaining hydration is essential, and in general, most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day, but each person's unique, and so talking with your healthcare team is important. Dehydration can actually amplify some of your side effects and make you feel more uncomfortable, so hydration is very, very important. And in closing, I just want to remind everyone there are several members of the healthcare team dedicated to you, and know how to reach them and know who they are, and reach out as soon as possible so we can help you as quickly as possible. I'm going to conclude now and hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a wonderful presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. There always are around what to eat, how to eat, what to do. So definitely just a great presentation. Thank you. And I'm actually going to go next just to talk a little bit about cancer care services for all of you, just briefly, and then we'll go right into the Q&A, of course. So Cancer Care offers a host of, we're a national organization, and we offer a host of free national programs and services. And many people call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-4673, and an oncology social worker answers the phone. We have about 40 oncology social workers, and so they're in queue to answer the phone so you don't have a wait time. And so people often will call about things like practical and financial assistance, transportation to treatment, food insecurity, requesting counseling services. So the social worker will go over all those things with them and get them those services, but then they will also go over them all the different things that we offer. So in addition to the things I've just mentioned, we also have a number of online support groups. And we have online support groups for people with cervical cancer, for people with all types of cancers, for people who are dealing with treatment side effects, for caregivers, for older adults, younger adults, middle-aged adults, young adults. So we have lots of different programs. And if you go to our website, www.cancercare.org, you'll be able to see the whole host of online support groups that we offer. And they are very helpful to people. Many people prefer an online support group. No travel involved, and it really works very well for people. And then we also offer these programs, about 80 a year. We also have many publications and many fact sheets, and they're all accessible on our website. So for a really comprehensive review of everything we offer, go to www.cancercare.org. And we'll be sending you all this information as well in the SurveyMonkey evaluation. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Krista to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Krista?
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Dr. Einstein. How does being HIV positive affect the risk of cervical cancer?
That's an excellent question. So we know that individuals living with HIV have some issues with their immune system. Now, the good thing is that, you know, we have come so far with antiretroviral therapies and with excellent treatment programs that, you know, individuals now live with HIV. But we also know that it does set them up for some elements of immune dysfunction. And unfortunately, cervical cancer is one of those diseases that certainly is increased in individuals living with HIV. Another disease, by the way, that has most recently come up that is of a big challenge, and that is anal cancer as well, which is another HPV-associated disease. All these trials that we talk about, all these innovations, have unfortunately traditionally excluded individuals living with HIV. More recently, due to some of the more improvements in equity and some of the inclusive language in clinical trials, we are actually doing less to include patients unless there's a scientific reason to exclude them from some of the more recent clinical trials. There's also a consortium dedicated to treatment of individuals called the AIDS Malignancy Consortium. I actually co-chair of the HPV Working Group, the AIDS Malignancy Consortium. We have a number of small trials for cervical cancer patients, so trials do exist just for individuals living with HIV, so we're trying to improve the outcomes in individuals living with HIV. But in general, the data has shown that survival is impacted as a result of their virus, is the short answer. But I gave the long one. Sorry about that, Carolyn.
That's a good answer. I think that's probably helpful to everybody on the call. Thank you. So thank you so much for being so comprehensive. And so the question for Dr. Runowitz, where within the cervix are cancer cells commonly found, and what is the likelihood of spreading to the uterus?
That's another good question. So the cancer cells are usually what we call the transformation zone, which is an area where the glandular cells meet the squamous cells. And that's an area that is tested when you do a traditional cervical cytology. And that's also an area that seems to be favored by HPV, human papillomavirus. So very good question.
Excellent, thank you. And the question for Dr. Einstein, when is fertility a concern and how can treatment be modified if I want to have children after the cancer is treated?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, first and foremost, it really sort of depends on a number of factors to begin with, you know, how big the cancer is, where the cancer is, and so seeking care with a GYN oncologist and having that discussion is the first discussion. I think on a positive side, there are fertility-sparing surgeries. There are fertility-sparing treatments that we can do from a surgical standpoint, including what we call, there are minimally invasive type of surgeries, including what we call radical trachelectomy, where we essentially remove just the cancer, the surrounding tissues around the cervix, and then we attach the lower uterine segment of the uterus on the vagina itself, and we put what we call a cerclage, which is essentially a special type of suture around the lower uterine segment to potentially hold the fetus in when getting pregnant, and that has actually had quite a bit of success with future fertilities over time. And I spoke earlier about the SHAPE trial, which where we could, maybe we, for some individuals, we don't have to do as big of surgery. We don't have to do that radical trachelectomy. We can actually get away with doing something called a cone biopsy, which is just a more of a, just a deeper excision of the cervix with what we call a node dissection. Only in the case that there's metastatic disease do we have to do something more robust, including radiation, and have that decision. I think the most important thing is start with the GYN oncologist and see if even a fertility-sparing option is possible with the different modalities of treatment that are available.
And a question for Dr. Ronowitz, can HPV be passed on to my child during childbirth?
No, not that we're aware of. But if you have HPV, I'd like to have Dr. Einstein weigh in on this one. If you have HPV at the time of delivery, I guess it's theoretically possible that the child would have some HPV, but in my mind it would be very low. But Dr. Einstein is actually a really well-known expert in this area.
Dr. Einstein?
You know, it's not just being exposed to HPV, that's the concern when it comes to this. So, I mean, let's face it, we have bacteria, viruses all over our environment, all over our microbiome. I always tell our patients, you know, our skin, our other epithelium in our throat, in the vagina, in the anus, it's all teeming with viruses and bacteria. Just by having them doesn't necessarily that we're going to get disease as a result of it. So, you know, a baby coming out of the vaginal tract might be exposed to these sort of microbiome pathogens, but they won't necessarily develop a persistence of that infection. In fact, that just doesn't happen. Most people that actually get exposed to HPV actually never get a persistent HPV infection. That's a good thing. I mean, HPV is ubiquitous. HPV and papillomavirus species in general across mammalian species has been in existence for millennia. I mean, we've identified papillomavirus species that have been identified in fossils that predate dinosaurs. This virus has been around as long as we've been around as humans. So it's always going to be there. That doesn't mean that it's going to cause some element of disease. And the same thing to what Dr. Ronowitz has said, it's, you know, baby is exposed to it in the birthing tract. That doesn't mean that in fact it will not get a persistent infection. It will not develop anything as a result of that.
Thank you. And a question for you, Dr. Einstein. Is it recommended to test for biomarkers after being diagnosed with cervical cancer? If so, how can that impact treatment?
Yeah, you know, I think we've really made a big, it's a great question, and it is, I think, a regional change that, and we're lucky that the companies that do a lot of these biomarker testings have really made it very accessible to everyone, that essentially all these tumors, when they come out, we essentially send it for this pretty extensive tumor testing, where we could actually not only look for the ones that I talked about, these tissue tests that we actually have treatments for, like PD-1, so that we use one of the immune checkpoint inhibitors, but also for some of the tissue targets and the vascular endothelial targets and other things too, but also for in the recurrent setting as well. So sometimes when patients recur in the recurrent setting, how we figure that out, they might not have had the opportunity to have that tissue testing at the original surgery because this is relatively new in the community. So the key is to actually get the original blocks of tumor of wherever the original biopsies of the tumor were done or the original surgery was done from the tumor. So if an individual out there or an individual's family member out there in the audience is suffering from a recurrence of their cancer, it might behoove you to seek to get some of those blocks to and request that your provider get those blocks sent for tissue testing, because that might help guide with some of the current treatments that we have available in the second and third line for the treatment of cervical cancer. It's not completely needed, but it might help.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And question for Dr. Runowitz. Does risk increase if there is a family history of cervical cancer, and should I get screened more often?
That's another good question. We don't think of cervical cancer as running in families as we do, say, for breast or ovary or prostate or melanoma. However, there have been clusters of families who may be more susceptible to the HPV integrating into the cell and, you know, starting the process. We don't think of it as a familial. We think more of it as an environmental. But certainly, doing a very thorough family history is important because you'll never know what is going to show up in your family history. So I would say in general, this is not an inherited, but we do see clusters, and so there may be a genetic predilection.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Einstein. Can you discuss current clinical trials for patients with advanced cervical cancer?
Yes. You know, I had mentioned, you know, the mature data of TIVTAK. There's actually a few more what we call antibody drug conjugates that are currently under study advanced or recurrent cervical cancer. There's also a couple of other immune checkpoint inhibitors that are currently under study in combination with other cytotoxics in phase two trials that are very exciting. My recommendation would be to reiterate what Dr. Runowitz had said at the beginning of the call, go on clinicaltrials.gov to look for recruiting trials right now in recurrent cervical cancer. We're thrilled to actually see that there are a lot of trials that are recruiting, and whether you're in, you know, wherever you are, certainly in the United States or in Canada, likelihood is that the academic medical center or the large community center might have access to one of those trials that are out there. And I'm glad that you asked whoever asked out there of your interest in a clinical trial. You know, keep in mind that a lot of the trials, particularly for cervix cancer, are utilizing usually the standard therapies, and then they're usually adding, shall I say, the kicker on top of it. They're adding that novel agent on top of it. So, or they're randomizing it to what would be the usual treatment standards of what would usually be given. And typically patients get not just the standard of care, but they get more frequent testing, they get more frequent care. And, you know, I always say one, the risk factors for someone coming out of clinical trials already having been on one because they realize the wonderful care that they get while being on a trial. So certainly seek to be on a clinical trial, and I applaud the question that was given.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And it's true that the care one gets in a clinical trial is so magnificent, really is incredible. Thank you. And then a question for Dr. Runowitz. What recommendations do you have for reducing or alleviating side effects like vaginal dryness as a result of radiation therapy?
So that's a complicated question because it depends on the age of the patient. It depends on the family history. And then it also depends on the physical exam. But local therapies such as vaginal dilators and local estrogen can work wonders on dry atrophic, we call it professionally, vaginal changes. One thing I did learn recently, I've started to look into the economics of drugs, and I was astounded that the cost of a certain estrogen cream was something like $500 or $600 per tube. So be sure to ask your provider if you do use estrogen cream, do the generic. It will save you hundreds of dollars. And the other is that it is absorbed. So you need to be under the guidance of a healthcare provider, either a nurse or a physician or somebody who's familiar with the side effects of estrogen, but they're really, local estrogen will absolutely help locally. The other is systemic estrogen. If you've had radiation and you still have a uterus present, you're going to need estrogen plus progesterone. And it's a little bit complicated because there can be some cervical stenosis where the cervix is narrowed and not open. And if you take hormone therapy and the cervix isn't draining, it can be a problem. So my advice is make sure that you're under the care of a physician, a gynecologist, a gynecologic oncologist, a nurse practitioner who's familiar with this. But don't suffer. There are treatments available.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I guess this is the last question. Which type of surgery is recommended for radical hysterectomy?
Is that for me?
No.
Oh, a great question. You know, we spent years developing minimally invasive techniques for a radical hysterectomy, and a couple of years ago we had two randomized trials that actually showed that doing it minimally invasive actually might worsen survival. So we have actually shifted back to open surgeries for radical hysterectomies, which is unfortunate. I mean, one of the nice things, though, is we don't have to be as radical, shall I say, for the lymph node dissection, which is a requirement of a radical hysterectomy. We actually have ways, techniques of doing sentinel node assessment, which is similar to like for sentinel node for breast cancer. We could do the same for cervical cancer. So we don't have to necessarily do the full lymph node dissection. We could take the sentinel node so that baby patients might not have to suffer with the lymphedema and the other side effects of the lymph node dissection. But we have essentially shifted back completely to doing open procedures for radical hysterectomy.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank our speakers. You've really been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants as well. And I'm going to ask our speakers if you would provide takeaways for our participants on today's program. So I'll start with Dr. Runowitz, then Dr. Einstein, Ms. Bearden, and Ms. McClellan. So Dr. Runowitz, if you'd like to start with just a takeaway, a minute and a half takeaway of
sure.
people's takeaway from the call.
Yeah. Sure. I think my takeaways are that this is a team sport, that you want to have a treating team, which includes a head of the team, which is usually a gynecologic oncologist, but you want to make sure that there's a pathologist, a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, social workers, dietitians, and that team will provide the best care for you initially, and if you recur, in the recurrent setting.
Thank you so much. Thanks. And Dr. Einstein?
Yes, first, thank you very much for joining us. And just a take-home point, we are really focusing less on the surgical aspects and more on the multimodal aspects, inclusion of precision medicine and some of the molecular techniques actually help hone down and individualize the treatment that we can do. As Dr. Runowitz said, having a GYN oncologist sort of help to orchestrate whether a combination of surgery or surgery alone or in combination with other procedures or using chemotherapy or radiation help, it really does help. Just because we can operate doesn't mean we should operate. And I say that, clearly because, some of these trials have really helped us to open up those doors, and utilizing the information from these trials can help us to go after those cures. And so think about a clinical trial. If you know of someone or if you yourself are suffering from cervical cancer, because, this is really the future of medicine. Everything that we're doing now at some point in time went through a clinical trial. And thank you all for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Einstein. And Ms. Bearden?
I just want to continue to encourage patients to be a voice for themselves, understand their resources, know their healthcare team and know how to access them, and realizing that when there is a change in how you're feeling or how you're responding to something, to reach out to your healthcare team as quickly as possible so that they can help you as quickly as possible.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Ms. McClellan.
I'm just really excited about all the new advances in cervical cancer. I was diagnosed in 2016, and just seeing the tremendous progress that's been made in the past years, just since I've been diagnosed, is really inspiring and very hopeful about the future of cervical cancer.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. I'd like to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I'd like to thank our participants as well. For asking such great questions, which enabled our speakers to then elaborate on additional points. But I do want to comment, we weren't able to take everyone's questions, so I want to comment about the questions and not leave you dangling here. So if you asked a question, if you have a question that is in queue that hasn't been answered yet, or if you're thinking of another question you want to ask, please, all of you, go back to your treating healthcare team and ask the question you asked on today's program. Remember, your healthcare team know you the best, and they will and ask your question of them, because they have all your medical records in front of them and can customize the answer even more so to you. Maybe the similar answers, but you want to be sure that you ask your healthcare team your questions. It's very important. And your healthcare team consists of so many different personnel. And so that no matter what your issue or concern may be, that your doctor, when you see a doctor, will be able to pull in members of the healthcare team to be able to help you. And most importantly, we would not want you to feel alone in coping with cervical cancer, any type of cancer. We want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and that community of support includes SHARE Cancer Support and Cancer Care and many other organizations out there, including your healthcare team, of course. We do not ever want to sidestep the healthcare team. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.